Hi, I'm Karen Hart Glass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. We are live here on Progressive Radio Network today on February 24th, 2015. And we're feeling alive. We're freezing feeling alive, aren't we, here in the, on the East Coast? It's crazy here, and looking forward to some changes. I'm really glad to be here, and I want to shout out to the great staff at Progressive Radio Network. We've been having some challenges and moving, and we're still here. We're still here. I want to bring on my guest today, Ricky Heller, Ph.D., RHN, an award-winning blogger, educator, recipe developer, and the author of Naturally Sweet and Gluten-Free, and associate editor for Simply Gluten-Free magazine. She lives in Ontario, where it's also very cold. And you can find her at rickyheller.com. She's got a new book. We're going to be talking a bit about that, a lot about it, actually, Living Candida Free. Ricky, how are you doing today?
I'm good. How are you? Nice. I'm glad we managed it.
I know. Me too. I'm really glad. You just never know with anything. You can never be certain of anything.
Absolutely agreed.
And, you know, that's a good way to live your life. Never expect anything. You'll never be disappointed.
That is true. That is true.
And then you always end up with some fun surprises, like doing this program today, which I wasn't sure was going to happen. But now it's happening, so let's celebrate and make the most of it.
Sounds good.
So tell me, how cold is it in Toronto?
We have broken so many records.
Congratulations.
I beg your pardon?
Congratulations.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, you can look at it. See, there you go. It's looking at the positive. I think apparently we just broke a 143-year record, I heard, or something like that, for coldest February. It's the first February where we've never gone above zero, which is above freezing in Celsius. So, like, nothing above 32, I guess, Fahrenheit.
Mm. Wow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And how do you stay light and humorous during this period?
Well, what alternative do you have?
Yeah.
I was just telling someone how I'm getting used to wearing two pairs of pants, four sweaters, two pairs of gloves, a hat with earmuffs on top of it. Like, it's crazy just to walk my dog. It takes me longer to get dressed than we're actually walking.
Oh, I was going to say you wear all that indoors, right? And then you really bundle up when you go out.
Yeah, really.
All right. Let's talk about your latest book and all of your adventures. So we're going to be talking about Candida and how to be Candida free. And the first thing I want to say is Candida. Do you know the origin of that word? It's such a happy sounding name. Candida. You know, I can think of all kinds of ways.
You know what? I don't actually. Isn't that hilarious? I do know it's pronounced differently, though, if you're talking to an alternative practitioner or an allopathic practitioner.
Oh, how do we say it?
So we say, in the alternative holistic world, we say Candida. But if you're talking to a conventionally trained doctor, they call it Candida.
Oh,
and
wow.
So I think that's the Latin term, like Candida albicans. Mm. So that may have something to do with it. And I've been corrected in the past because I was pronouncing it wrong. But in fact, every alternative practitioner does call it Candida, so even naturopaths. And for some reason, I kind of like that divide because it shows that we're actually talking about something that's slightly different.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the alternative world, we're talking about this syndrome that I have been dealing with. But if you're talking to a conventional doctor, what they mean by Candida is there's a condition called candidiasis, which is basically a blood infection of this fungus, and it is literally deadly. Like, you need to be treated immediately and aggressively, or you're going to die. So that may also be part of the reason why over the years conventional doctors have kind of looked at you askance if you say I have Candida, because they think you'd be dead. So it's a completely different. We're talking about something that begins in the gut and has more to do with an imbalance in the gut, and they're talking about an actual bloodborne disease.
Wow, you say Candida, and I say Candida.
I like to say blame
Candida. Candida, let's call the whole thing off. Well, now that's part of the frustration and the challenge that so many people have who have what we're going to call Candida.
Mm-hmm.
Candida. I just want to keep singing. It's such a melodic kind of word. I don't have the same feeling about it as you do, so you probably don't really want to sing about it.
Well, maybe now, not at the beginning for sure.
And as you said, you know, doctors, conventional, traditional doctors, don't even acknowledge its existence, although I want to think that maybe more and more they are, because they're learning from the alternative practitioners.
And I think, yes, I really think the situation is changing. We're sort of in transition now because this whole branch of functional medicine, which is much more prevalent in the U.S. than it is here in Canada, although there are some functional doctors here, but very few and far between. But you have this branch of functional medicine that is now really like an integrative, complementary way of looking at the body and health. And so they're acknowledging Candida, and they're also using established scientific methods at the same time. So I think that brings a whole new realm of credibility to this, because if, you know, someone like Mark Hyman or Andrew Weil are looking at this and saying, yeah, it exists, then the rest of the world's going to start to take note too.
All right. So if you have Candida, what are you experiencing?
All kinds of fun things. So, you know, this is one of those conditions where it can actually spread to so many different systems in the body that the symptoms can be far-ranging. And initially what you're going to get are certain symptoms, and then as it gets worse, it will spread to other systems. So initially, if you have really intense sugar cravings that really feel beyond what normal sugar cravings would be, just completely out of control, that's a real tip-off. And also, people often begin with all kinds of digestive distress. So my first symptom, years before I was diagnosed with Candida, was IBS. First I was told that I had IBS mm-hmm. because they couldn't figure out what was wrong with me. And then that can then become Candida overgrowth over time, or it might be just a sign that you're starting to have Candida overgrowth. And then, because Candida is a yeast or fungus, all of these conditions that are connected to fungi, so yeast infections for women, jock itch for men, things like athlete's foot or fungal toenail mm-hmm. or fingernail mm-hmm. infections, and then what was my major symptom in 2009 when I was diagnosed for the second time was a fungal rash or Candida rash, which is, I mean, just looks like a regular rash, except that it's a little bit worse than your average rash because it's really red, really raw, and both itchy and painful at the same time, at least it was for me, but really, really itchy. So that can be, and it spreads like crazy if you don't get it under control. So that is another symptom that a lot of people get. And then from there, if it gets worse and it's not addressed, you know, you might end up with other symptoms. And some people have other symptoms before they get these, but for me, those were the ones that sort of started things off.
I'm sure conventional medicine just wants to throw medication when you have a rash like you experienced.
I put every cream known to humankind on that rash, and mm-hmm. I was prescribed every cream known to humankind. I saw 7 dermatologists, and they gave me literally all of the antifungal creams they had, and nothing worked, nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'm getting the feeling, as we're learning more about the microscopic land in our bodies, and we're learning about bacteria and bugs and all those little tiny things, that it's going to open the door to a lot of good healing for things that have different names but are probably similar mm-hmm. in origin and just different in symptoms.
I think that's absolutely true. The more we learn, even like my IBS, right? I mean, certainly IBS is still a diagnosis, but, you know, someone might have connected it more quickly to Candida if we knew then sort of what we know now, right? And you hear a lot of talk about leaky gut syndrome and how that's often connected to Candida. So the microbiome, or that inner ecology that you were talking about, is so important, and I think we're just beginning to learn how important it is to keep that equilibrium inside our intestinal tract, and how so many of us have an imbalance just based on the lifestyle that we've been living, you know, without even doing anything that we would consider abnormal or wrong or extreme. Just the average lifestyle that we live now in North America can contribute to that kind of imbalance. It's crazy.
It's crazy. I just feel like singing today. I don't know what
right,
it is.
It's a great way to keep a good mood in this weather, for sure.
Yeah, stay tuned for more tunes. Now, you do a lot of explaining in the beginning of your book, and that's good, so people have a better feeling about candida and our whole digestive process, and things can really go awry in so many different places in our digestive tract.
Mm-hmm.
And if, yeah, one thing's connected to the next.
Yeah, and I want to just say that chapter one that describes the whole digestive process is actually by my collaborator, Andrea Nakayama, who is a functional nutritionist out of Portland. And so she actually does do the whole science approach. She's one of these people who manages to meld the holistic with the established scientific establishment. And so she, I think, does a brilliant job of really taking that process and making it something really understandable that we can all follow and comprehend in sort of layman's terms. But yeah, it's you know, when you think about it, really, as Andrea says, everything starts in the gut. Like, we have 70% of our immune system is housed in our gut, and all of the little microscopic organisms that you were talking about, like the germs and the parasites and the good bacteria and the bad bacteria and the candida and so on, there are 10 times as many of those organisms as we have cells in our body. So there are 10 times as many of them as there are of us. So you want to keep them happy.
Make friends with your microorganisms.
Yeah, because think about that, you know, that they keep you running smoothly.
I was spinning through this as you were chatting and lost my place. All right. I know what I wanted to ask you. Can you explain what a functional nutritionist is?
Yeah, I mean, here in Canada, we call it holistic nutritionist. They're very, very similar. So she takes a functional approach. She looks at the function of each organism, each system, and tries to connect that to what might be going wrong. So it's a much more holistic, and it's definitely an alternative approach. But she uses the scientific evidence to come to those conclusions. So the way I sort of summarize what she does is she takes a scientific approach to diagnosis and then a holistic approach to treatment for the most part, but it's rooted in the science. So she'll do like a blood analysis, and based on those results, then she will always first attempt to treat with the most natural therapies.
I love that.
Me too.
What
I really
concept.
Do. I wish we had more of that here in Canada.
Mm-hmm. I don't like going to doctors, but I like occasionally getting the diagnosis, getting the data, and then deciding what to do about it.
Exactly. Yeah, and you want someone who knows, you know, knows what will work and who can assess your individual situation, which is what functional medicine does too, is they take it on a case-by-case basis. Because I always say, one of the things I say in the book too is, you know, it always used to surprise me when, let's say, you know, my husband is 6'1", I'm 5'4". If we both go to the doctor for a sinus infection, we're going to get the same antibiotic in the same dosage for the same amount of time. To me, that never made sense. You know, he's got way more body mass than I do. You would think that they would adjust the dosage accordingly, but they don't. And so what functional medicine does is they really do look at each person individually, and even if you have the same diagnosis, you may end up with a different treatment based on how you ended up with that diagnosis.
I like it because it makes each one of us feel special.
Yeah.
And we should feel special.
Because we are, yes.
Yes, we should all have individual treatment. Yeah. Now, once you have candida, do you always have it?
Well, I guess it depends what you mean, but do you always have the symptoms and always suffer from it? No, absolutely not. You can definitely recover from candida. I've come to believe that it depends very much on the severity of the situation when you begin to treat it and how long you've let it go before you begin to treat it. So, for instance, in my case, I really kind of waited too long to go and get treatment. So it took me much longer the second time around to get to a point where I felt healthy again. And I have to be much more careful than the average person now, having had it and having gone through that, because I could very easily have a relapse if I start eating sugar again or I start drinking too much wine again or whatever like that. So for me personally, it's, I kind of think of it, not, I don't really want to give a negative analogy, but you know, the way an alcoholic is always an alcoholic, even if they've been sober for the rest of their life. There's definitely something there that could be triggered in my body and in anyone who's had a really severe case for a long time. However, at the same time, if someone has a mild case and they catch it early, you know, I know people who've gone from having candida to being completely clear of it in 3 months, and then they go back to their regular life and they never have to worry about it again. So again, it's case by case, individual, but some people yes, some people no.
And it's probably something we don't really have an clear understanding of. I'm thinking that you've totally changed your microbiome with your diet, and you've got a lot of happy, health-promoting bugs in your gut. But there's probably something we don't understand, and something related to memory. I like to think that not just the brain, but all parts of our body have memory.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how that's stored and how that's triggered, but stay tuned. We'll find that out in a few days.
And I think part of it is, you know, you can never eradicate all the candida because you're supposed to have some. So it's there. And so if it's ready to kind of spring back into action if you've dealt with an overgrowth before.
Now, what are the really bad foods? What are the things that candida love to thrive on?
Favorite food was my favorite food too, sugar. Refined sugar, refined flours, refined grains, white potatoes, anything that's easily converted to sugar in the body is the number one food for candida. But in terms of sort of triggers or situations that might cause candida to develop, and I don't want to, it's actually, candida is the result of something that's already happened, which is an imbalance in the microbiome. So candida itself isn't a disease, but it's the overgrowth of candida that results from that is the problem. So what can cause that overgrowth is anything that creates an imbalance to begin with. So you've probably heard, you know, like antibiotics will wipe out, of course, the bad bacteria that are giving you whatever infection it is, but they will also wipe out the good bacteria that keep that gut in balance. And so a lot of people have learned that they need to take yogurt or probiotics after a course of antibiotics. But really, once that happens, I've read that it will take up to 3 months to replace what you lose from 1 2-week course of antibiotics. So you should be taking probiotics for at least 3 months after every course of antibiotics. But so once those are wiped out, then that's a prime territory for candida. And anything that creates that kind of upset, anything that causes an acidic situation in the body, so, you know, we go between acid and alkaline, and sugar is very acid-forming in the body, as is red meat, as is coffee, as is alcohol, as is, to me, this one was the most surprising, but it does make sense, stress, very acid-forming in the body.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it all kind of comes together when you look back over your, you know, the triggers over the years. I think, I had that, check. So it's almost as if there was no way I wasn't going to end up with candida, given all of those possible triggers.
Now, something I like to say often is that when I restrict food from my diet, all of a sudden the world opens up and I'm eating more varied foods than ever before.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how you feel about that.
I feel that's exactly what happened to me when I went gluten-free. Because here I was thinking, oh, I can't have gluten anymore. It's going to be so restrictive. And what ended up happening was I found out about, you know, maybe a dozen different gluten-free grains that I never knew before. And I've said this before, I think I said this last time. I love baking more with gluten-free flours now than I did with regular flour because there's so much variety. And depending on your mood even, you know, do I feel like teff today or do I feel like sorghum? So, you know, there's just this vast array of possibilities. And I think that happens to a lot of people. They think they're going to end up being more restricted, but that kind of prompts them to go out and try foods they never would have tried otherwise.
Now, you're encouraging people to find their kitchens with this book and make a lot of things on their own, which is something that I always do because it's very important.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think, and I want to get into some of these recipes because they're stunning, and I just want to eat every page that I'm looking at right now because I'm hungry. but can people eat the way you're recommending and not make food at home?
Yes, you can, ultimately. At the very beginning, I would say it's probably more important to take the first few weeks and really be sure that you understand the diet and you can make all those things yourself, and also because that's going to help your body to clear out the toxins much faster and clear out the candida much faster. But, you know, I'm at the point now where I'm on what I call the maintenance level of candida diet, and so I go out to a restaurant. My husband, you know, before I met him, I think he lived in an apartment once for 2 years and used the oven once in 2 years. So he's used to eating in restaurants, and he loves to eat in restaurants. So we go out about once a week now. We used to go more when we were first dating. But, you know, I can eat in restaurants, and what happens is you can ease up on some of those restrictions as you continue through the diet. So I don't have a problem now. I can always find something, and then I have my favorite restaurants where I can find many things and you know, have a great variety. But, you know, I'll still go out with friends, and I don't have to ask them to go to a special restaurant for me because I can always find something that's okay within my parameters. At the beginning, you do want to learn, though, how to make a lot of this stuff yourself because you're healing, and you can't eat sugar, and if you read labels, you know that almost everything you buy or everything in a restaurant is going to contain sugar. So you really do have to be careful when you first start out.
Labels. Don't talk to me about labels. Later on in the program, I'm going to talk about my love or unlove or lack of love for labels because, you know, even though we read the labels, there are lies in the labels that we're learning more and more about. It is so frightening, which is another reason why it's so good to make food at home because you have that much more control over what's in your food.
Yeah, as much as you can, I think it's really crucial.
Okay, so you have basics here, and some of these basics are like basics for any cook at home, like making your own stock.
Mm-hmm, sure, yeah, anybody can do that. And it's that recipe that I actually borrowed one of the aspects of that from a Toronto area cookbook author named Noreen Gillitz. She's the first person I saw who threw the whole onion in with the skin in her stock.
Mm-hmm.
And it gives it this beautiful color, and it looks like meat stock or chicken stock, and it tastes, you know, you don't taste anything different, but it's very flavorful, and it works beautifully.
I like
that. And you don't have to peel the onion.
Right. I like if it's organic. And
yeah.
I like,
I
like it because it makes it easy and and tasty. Yeah.
And I'm all about quick and easy when it comes to cooking, as much as I can be.
Okay. Now, you have recipes for coconut milk and coconut butter using just grinding up shredded coconut.
Yes. And, you know, if you've ever bought that delicious raw coconut butter, or I think it's called coconut cream in some companies, it's delicious, but it's ridiculously expensive. So, again, like you were saying, you have more control. It's also much more economical. And literally, if you have a high-speed blender, it will take you less than 2 minutes to make that coconut butter.
I mean, this is crazy. I never realized you could do that. And I love every time I learn one more thing from somebody that I talk to on this program.
Oh,
but
great.
I mean, it's great because so many reasons. There's less packaging. It stays a long time. You can have it whenever you want.
Yep.
And basically, it's the flaked coconut is just the coconut without the water.
Yeah, unsweetened dried coconut. It has to be unsweetened, and it has to be fairly fresh, because if it's not, you know, it's dried, but if it's been sitting in the cupboard for 6 months, it gets even drier, and at that point you might have to add like a tablespoon of coconut oil just to moisten it up again.
This is very exciting. Well, everybody loves coconut milk, and it's so good for so many different things.
Oh, yeah, and particularly this diet, because coconut is one of the superstar foods that helps to actually kill the candida in your body.
Now, let's talk about grains.
Okay.
whole grains, are they good? Are they not good?
Yes, whole grains are good. Oh. I don't believe in demonizing whole grains. whole grains contain all kinds of fiber and vitamins and protein, and we need some carbs, and these are complex carbs, and they're good for you. They don't really spike your blood sugar levels. The only thing with the anti-candida diet is you are asked to eat gluten-free whole grains, because so many people have problems with gluten and may not even realize it. And what you're trying to do is limit any foods that would cause irritation to the digestive system. So we keep it at gluten-free grains. And I actually have just stayed on gluten-free grains ever since I started eating them. I've never gone back, even though at this point I could probably go back and have spelt or kamut or something like that. But I love the gluten-free.
No.
And why mess with it if it works?
Now, someone, I forget who I was talking to, and I've yet to try it, but making millet flour out of the millet grains, and I was told it was really easy, and I've yet to get around to doing that.
I do that, yeah. Some people use a high-speed blender. I use a coffee grinder, like a spice
uh-huh.
grinder, and I just put it in, it's small, a small amount, but if you put in a quarter of a cup of millet, you're going to end up with close to half a cup of flour. And that, for my purposes, like I'll usually use it for pancakes or something like that, that's more than enough for what I need. But you can just do a couple of batches if you need more flour. And the reason why I think that's better is because you are starting with a whole grain that you know is still intact and hasn't been processed except to be dried. Whereas with flour, it's often gone through further processing. So
mm-hmm.
what's weird for me is I'll sometimes react to millet flour, but I won't react to millet ground up into flour.
Because other things must have gotten mixed into that flour.
Yeah, and even just the processing, they've changed the sort of the chemistry of it, right? It's not identical to just ground up millet anymore. It's
yeah, it's not as fresh either.
Mm-hmm, that is probably exactly. It's probably not.
Yeah. So I'm looking at your whole grain waffles where you're using raw or toasted buckwheat groats, uncooked millet, and some other basic waffle ingredients.
Yep.
And
so you're basically turning that into flour for that recipe. You're grinding them up and turning it into flour, and
right.
then, yeah.
Yeah, I like it. Giving me some new ideas.
Oh, good. And lots of desserts, of course, because, you know, I'm a sweets addict, and that's what got me in trouble in the first place. But these are anti-candida desserts that will not feed the yeast.
And that's because for a sweetener, you use stevia.
Yeah, I use stevia, and I use, to a very small extent, actually not in this book. Since the book came out, I've been experimenting with xylitol, which I do quite like. But in the book, it's stevia and some miocone syrup, and in a very few instances, there are a couple of fruits that you're allowed in the second stage of the diet. But I wanted all the recipes as much as possible to be suitable for someone just starting out. So there are only, I think, like three recipes that are stage two, and everything else is suitable no matter where you are in the diet.
So what fruits can you eat in stage two?
You start to introduce what they call non-sweet fruits, which is an odd name, but anyway, things like apples, pears. You can have berries. They're very low glycemic, blueberries, blackberries, raspberries, things like that that won't really affect blood sugar to any great extent. And then by the third phase, you can reintroduce almost anything except the very sweet fruits, the ones that they consider the sweetest, like dried fruits are all very sweet, and bananas and mangoes, those kind of really sweet ones.
Mm-hmm.
But again, like I'm at the point where I can have those every once in a while now.
Yay.
I guess. Yeah,
good.
I love them.
I'm going to rant here a minute. I'm looking at your hummus recipe, and I was on Facebook the other day, and I saw a sponsored post by Sabra, and it had like 20,000 gazillion likes and all these people talking about their hummus, and I was steaming, because have you ever read the ingredients on Sabra hummus?
A long time ago, I don't know.
Okay, number one, it's not organic, so boo.
Right.
But number two, other than potassium sorbate, which is a preservative that I don't feel like eating, they use soybean oil.
Oh, my God. I bet they've changed their recipe.
Yeah, and they call it traditional or classic. And there's nothing classic about it, because hummus, which came from Turkey in the Middle East, where they have a lot of olive oil and not soybean oil, hummus doesn't have soybean oil in it.
Right.
and you know it's genetically modified.
Oh yeah, that's bad. I think when they first started out, I believe that they started out in, I could be wrong if they're a Canadian company, but when they were really small and just starting out, I think, as I recall, their ingredient list was slightly different, because I don't remember those being in it.
They probably got bought by somebody else.
Mine's not traditional either, is it?
No, but yours looks good. Yeah, we've done a lot of variations on hummus since, so yours has almond butter in it.
Yeah.
And because, you know, we don't really need to have a lot of oil, and it's good to have foods that have fiber in them. Fat with fiber, right?
Yeah. I find it helps. It makes it creamy.
Yeah. But you also include the tahini, which is an important flavor in traditional hummus.
Right.
Yeah. I don't use olive oil in my hummus either, although I love olive oil, and I could drink it up, but I don't.
Yeah, that's probably a good idea. Good plan.
Yeah. And right next to it is a nice raw almond veggie pate. Very good.
My favorites too, yeah.
Yeah.
And these are all pretty easy to make for people who may not be used to cooking a lot. I mean, the veggie pate, you soak your almonds, rinse them, you throw everything in the food processor, you're done.
Now, another one that I just wanted to mention is, and I rarely see this. I mean, I do it, but I rarely see it. And you've got this garlicky, warm avocado sauce.
Mm-hmm.
And I love when avocado is warm.
Mm-hmm. I do in sauces like that. And I also sometimes use it in baking as an egg substitute, actually. But I think, you know, you make a lovely sauce and toss your pasta with it. I think it's delicious that way. And cold. I just like it every which way.
Oh, I love it. Yeah, but I find that there's a different flavor somehow that's brought out when it's warm.
Yeah, I agree. I think
really.
It's like having a whole different food.
All right, so we're pretty much at the end, and I just wanted to ask you if you have some wise words, in addition to buying your book, what people who think they have candida should be doing right now.
Well, the first thing you want to do is cut out refined sugar from your diet, and I would suggest speak to a holistic nutritionist or functional nutritionist or naturopath. I think you call it naturopath in the States. Someone who can assess your symptoms. There are online questionnaires you can take that will help to assess your symptoms, so use that and see how your score comes out. But if you do suspect, I mean, you want to be working with someone who's dealt with candida before and can help you work through the diet and knows which supplements you would need to take. So I would say seek out some professional help.
Okay. Well, you know, I think whether you have candida or not, the recipes in this book are... they look delicious, and they're health-promoting.
Yep.
And just like I was saying before, there are many different ailments and diseases, I think, that have different symptoms, but probably the same original causes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was thinking when I was going through advanced ovarian cancer about 8 years ago, I stayed away from sugar. And I was curious what you called the sweet fruits, because I was eating berries, but I really stayed away from anything that could feed those bad cancer cells.
Mm-hmm.
And this book would probably help anyone going through that sort of crisis as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, one of the more recent theories about cancer is that it is a fungus. So... if that's the case, then this is the ideal diet. You want a sugar-free diet for sure, and a diet that's very alkalizing and high in vegetables, absolutely.
Oh, great. Well, then maybe in a few years you could repackage the book with a different name. And
I'll talk to a publisher about that for sure.
Call it the anti-cancer diet or something like that. Oh, okay. Or maybe something, well, anyway, it's good. Just the way it is. Ricky, thank you for joining me on It's All About Food. Stay warm.
You too. Thanks a lot. Nice to talk to you again.
Okay. Nice talking with you. Whew. There you go. That was Ricky Heller, living candida free, and you can find her at rickyheller.com.